Hello and welcome to another installment of A Door Into the Dark, where your English department explore your junior cycle and leaving cert texts. Today we're taking another look at Hamlet, but we're moving away from character and having a look at theme. And I'm again joined by Georgia Lee Flynn and Sean O'Brien, again, who's losing his voice. So again, really appreciative that he's on the podcast, chatting away with us on Hamlet and giving you guys some insights in, you know, different insights from maybe the teachers that you have. And always good to get a different viewpoint on some of the topics. So today we're going to focus on the theme of corruption. So how big is this theme? Is it an important theme? Where do we see this theme in the text then, guys?
I think corruption is at the heart of Hamlet, really, and it seems to start from the very first corrupt act that happens even before the play begins, with the murder of old King Hamlet. And the corruption just seems to spread like a disease throughout the court. And as I keep telling my class, you know, if the head of the state is corrupted, then the whole state is corrupted. So if the monarchy is corrupt, if it's decaying, if it's diseased, then, you know, the country is not okay. And the very first quote, or the very obvious quote that comes to mind, is that there's something rotten in the state of Denmark. So I think corruption is at the heart of the play, and it seems to spread from character to character. Like, even the uncorruptible or the incorruptible, the characters that we would label as the good characters, like Ophelia, like Laertes, they all end up corrupt or dead by the end of the play.
Yeah, they're corrupted by
association.
By characters wanting to either further their position or maintain their position. As often, it comes from the old, like, as it comes from Polonius as well as Claudius, that idea that in order to kind of maintain control over the things that are happening, they start, like, controlling information and controlling the way people interact with one another. Like, it seems a little bit more benign with Polonius because he's an oaf. Like, he's such a, like, he's so,
it's great so, like, to describe, he's Polonius, so,
like,
yeah,
pompous and, like, just, yeah. Like, that's such a small thing, but it's so, like, duplicitous. Like, the way he gets your man to follow Laertes to Paris. Like, it's a small, it's an interesting, like, that it's a small thing in that it's a domestic concern, but it just highlights the idea that these people who are in power want to hold on to it and want to hold on to information and control information and don't reveal themselves, yet try to come up with games and tricks to reveal, for you to reveal yourself while you're still in the making of your own fortune or your own personality. So it's so toxic. Like Polonius really, like, jumps on any chance to be involved in his kids' lives in, like, really, like, voyeuristic, uncomfortable way. Like, the way he jumps in on Ophelia's love life and the way he jumps in on Laertes's life in Paris.
Yeah, all this general stuff.
Yeah, I said to my class as well, like, Hamlet literally says, like, Denmark is a prison.
Yeah.
Like, he's living in a surveillance state. Like, every move he makes is closely watched by the court. And, you know, they said things like, well, he's a prince, you know, surely he can pull a bit of rank. But they really can't. Like, even if you think about the royal family nowadays, like, wow, they're the royal family, like, that, you know. But what actual freedom do they really have?
No.
They are political figureheads. They are expected to act, behave, and carry out their life in a particular way. Like, Hamlet, Laertes tells us that Hamlet's will is not his own. So as powerful as you think he might be, he cannot make decisions for himself.
Yeah.
Everything is done through the state. And Claudius is now sitting at the head of the state, who, if we believe the ghost, is an incredibly corrupt and immoral person. Who's committed murder, who's usurped his brother's throne, who's married his wife as well, which was not acceptable even at those times, for anybody who thinks, like, just back then, it's grand, like, you can just marry your brother's widow. It was still controversial. And, you know, all of the incestuous sheets and the, you know, it's really, like, grimy and kind of a gross place to be.
Yeah, but he uses every single one of his levers is in trying to mask his guilt and to like find out things about Hamlet. So he uses Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, like all the things that might be turned into like a positive thing, he usurps and tries to turn into a thing to promote his own for his benefit, basically.
He's a master manipulator.
Yeah, like, really, because you because he's often played so like straight, like, you know, like he doesn't give too much away for an awful lot of it. He's usually this like cold I always think of Patrick Stewart, like powerful bald head, like this weird eagle who's like removed from everything and like making big decisions and like having and like revealing nothing to anyone, like not even to Gertrude. Like he gives nothing away to anyone, only to us in that moment before his like guilt and his prayer for
it's so
and even
funny.
That feels like it's fake, you know.
Like, I always read him as like a really kind of Weasley character that's like trying to hang on to appearance at any cost, and that he married Gertrude to try and, you know, buff himself up.
Yeah.
You know, when Hamlet takes him into, or when Gertrude takes Hamlet into her chambers and he holds up the photographs and he says, you know, look at my father. Hmm. Look how far you've fallen.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Look at this man, and this is who you've married, like in pure disgust. Yeah. Like, they just don't compare to each other. Yeah. And the nation loved Hamlet. They're loyal to his son as well. So I feel like Claudius is actually, although the king, in quite a precarious situation, and he needs to spread his agenda, spread his corruption in order to kind of cement his place.
To maintain himself within it. Like, his corruption and Hamlet's subsequent fear of being found out that he's going to try and kill him is ultimately, I think, what drives Ophelia to killing herself. Or, you know, like, certainly their breakdown of a relationship. He has to perform madness to her and to tell her to go away and to play with her heart to keep Claudius off the scent. And so she is just, you know, roadkill on the way to him trying to maintain his power. And so it even forced Hamlet to do it. So, like, as you say, Georgia Lee, very, like, we could kind of just take your opening salvo at the start and go, like, just that, exactly that. But that idea that he's, if you're, like all of these characters get corrupted because they're all trying to morph around a thing that's already corrupted at the center of it all.
Mm. Like, if you put an apple beside a rotten apple, it's going to go bad really quickly. Like, that's exactly kind of how I imagine it happening in the court. And I think Hamlet's fear of ending up like Claudius, or, you know, of being so opposite to his father who he idolized, really drives him to not want to, again, like our last podcast, to procrastinate, to not want to kill him, to not want to be corrupted by everything that's going on around him. And I think he saw the corruption in Polonius as the right-hand man to Claudius, the fake king. Yeah. And I also think it's why he didn't have as much remorse as maybe he should have when he kills Polonius. He basically feels nothing about it.
No, he feels nothing.
He's killed a rat, as he says.
Yeah.
Like, a disease-spreading rodent has been killed and removed from the court, so...
Yeah. And, like, and that gets... It also comes out then when... like, we can't even have a fair fight, you know, like the fencing, like we have to poison the drink in case he comes over and needs us up, and we have to poison the blade, even, like, you know, everything has to, I have to ensure through nefarious acts that, like, I just can't let honor stand, like, because if I allow that to happen, I'm found out, I'm done for, you know. But it's the idea that corruption started, like, the fish, like, rots from the head down, like, you know, it's that same idea that, like, corruption starts at the top and it forces everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you look at Trump's first presidency and, like, force, like, you know, because he wants to hold on to the idea of his, like, this fantastic win, he forces Sean Spicer to come out and lie through his teeth. Like, this was the most people who ever appeared
about Sean Spicer
as a presidential address ever, you know? And, like, this guy knows it's not true. And he's like, I've hitched myself to this cart. So, like, I have to just, like, land on this grenade here, you know? Like, it was such a clear indication that he's such an odious man, because, like, so many people had to, like, land on the various grenades that he set through his own kind of bullish ways, you know, and Claudius is no different.
So if corruption is at the heart of Hamlet, is Claudius the pumping aorta?
I think it is, and as much as I hate to say it as well, like, humans are corrupt and corruptible.
Yeah.
Yes, like, we have been since the beginning of time. If something is benefiting us, we're probably going to let it continue to benefit us in life. And I think that Shakespeare's actually pointing out, with this thoughtful main character that's really hung up on morals and really doesn't want to curse his soul or anybody else's, I think he's kind of making us pause and think about that. Like, look at all of the carnage left over from the corruption of one corrupt act.
Yeah.
So it's like one stone in the pond just sends a ripple effect throughout the whole country, and, you know, by extension, if we want to go really existential, like the world.
Yeah.
You know, so like if you put bad out there,
yeah,
bad is going to come back.
Yeah.
So I think there's a really good message there as well. And Claudius is the start of it. He's the catalyst, and he adds fuel to the flames constantly,
yeah,
throughout the play, with Ophelia, with Laertes, with Rosencrantz Guildenstern. Yeah. As Sean said, he corrupts them and turns them on Hamlet, yeah, even though they don't know that they're delivering, yeah, him to his death. So even the innocent aren't,
yeah,
innocent. They're not protected.
Yeah.
So like, just wanting to be good isn't enough in the world of Hamlet.
Yeah. Or maybe in our world as well. Yeah, well, you know, like that idea that, like corruption, negativity, and acting in bad faith can ripple out like that. But just as much as that's the case, acting in good faith ripples out.
Absolutely.
As well. And that, like, we need to there's no drama in that though. So we don't read many stories about how like good faith ripples out.
Yeah.
I think Ted Lasso is doing a great job of like of hitting
the,
that.
The Bible,
mark.
Sean, the Bible.
Yeah, I was just gonna just say, God,
best selling book in the world. Or is that Harry Potter?
I think the Bible actually.
It is.
Well,
like
George Bernard Shaw was his line was, you know, lots of people are able to talk about a whole day by the seaside, but nobody can describe 5 minutes in heaven, because like if we all attain the perfect ideal that we can live by, the drama of life is taken away. You know, like, so it's the drama is what draws us to, like, and what we want to learn from. But we probably want our own lives to be incredibly boring and like content and like quiet and sedate, yeah, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't sell, I guess, you know, doesn't put on seats.
Yeah,
but so yeah, like I just think that it's just as we're talking to teenagers who, you know, like certainly when I was a teenager, I could spin out on like negativity and like, you know, really romanticize it. Like it also works the other way, you know, just that we should little health warning on that one. Like, but but it's so true. Like that, if from that one act, everything then has to turn around and work in bad faith, and it takes someone standing up to it to turn the tide potentially, you know. And Hamlet does do that ultimately.
And I'm gonna go a bit rogue here. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, right, you've brought them up quite a bit, the two of you. So who are they as characters? What, you know, some productions might get rid of them, some productions put them together as just one. There's a great play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which totally is really funny play, totally gives a total, yeah, like, and like Georgia Lee, you said, you know, they're actually innocent in the whole thing, you know, you see that from their whole point of view, like, what's going on in Hamlet, you know, you kind of see what's, yeah, when they kind of leave Hamlet, they kind of have these scenes between each other, yeah, and be like, why did you think Claudius brought us here, I don't know, what's going on, Hamlet's
and like,
mad,
also, if
and
like, the king know, invites you to his country, you're not, yeah, going to be like, nah, mate, sorry, I actually
they
don't want to go.
They say that, don't they? Yeah. They say something like, you know, they're like, we're so happy that you blessed us with your presence. And like, yeah, we also could have just told us to be here, and we would have
yeah,
called anyway.
Yeah,
you know,
like, who are they to say no?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, are they innocent? Do they know what they're doing? Are they totally corrupt? Are they more corrupt than Claudius is?
Ooh. I told you
I was going rogue.
Yeah, I was rogue.
I feel like it depends on your perspective or your mindset. Yeah. Like, if I was being really negative, I'd be like, oh, yeah, they were just trying to get close to Claudius and crawl their way, yeah, up through their friend Hamlet. But I like to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, no, like, these are just two college students from Wittenberg that came over to see their friend Hamlet at the request of the king, who they can't turn down. And they wanted to be, you know, gracious guests. So they did what was asked of them, and like, it ended up that their friend sent them to their deaths, and that's really tragic. And,
yeah,
you know, they're not really given a lot of voice other than to follow orders from either Hamlet or Claudius, mm-hmm, and then they're killed. But, like, if you reverse it, if we look at it through a corrupt lens,
yeah,
you know, they could be there as spies, and they could be fully aware of what they're doing and just acting and manipulating Hamlet into telling them kind of what he's thinking and what his plans are so that they can protect Claudius, because ultimately Claudius is currently in a position of power and can offer them more than Hamlet can.
Yeah, that's true. When I first considered the question, it was the idea when you first brought them up was the idea that their innocence and their they are highlighting the corrupting influence of Claudius. Mm. That even as Georgia Lee said, even the innocent are corrupted through no fault of their own. But
I suppose they're outsiders as well. And it shows the spread to outside of Denmark as well.
Place. There is definitely the sense of also that they're like they're just bros, like, you know, they want to
come in.
Talk about drinking and, like, you know, all this sort of stuff, like, that they just want to...
And now they're part of a political conspiracy.
Yeah. Kind of like, I don't know if you've ever seen Burn After Reading, that Coen Brothers movie. Yeah. Brad Pitt is, like, unwittingly steps in on this government conspiracy and stuff like that. That they're maybe a little bit like that, but... Yeah, I suppose I'd never considered it from the perspective of that they're just trying to milk Hamlet for whatever crust or influence that they can generate from it.
Or they just don't have any, you know, like you say, it's like we go back to that idea, corruption's at the heart of Denmark. You know, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark and they have no choice and they're just part of this corruption and they have to keep going because they don't want their heads on.
Yeah, what's the alternative?
I think
we have to remember as well, like, the power dynamic, like, what rank or position do either of those have in Denmark?
Mm.
Zero.
Yeah.
Like, if I went and the president asked me to do something, if he said, you know, would you give that envelope to so-and-so? I didn't know that there was, like, poison in the letter and I handed it over. Like, was it my fault?
Yeah.
Or was it his fault? I feel a bit like I find it easier to view them as the innocent because they're so interchangeable and they're just not given any importance. Yeah. And sometimes they call them, like, Guildenkrantz and Rosenstern. Yeah, yeah. And, like, sometimes they'll condense them into one character. Like, if they were this scheming, plotting duo, maybe they'd be given a little bit more prominence in the play.
They're one of the few characters whose, like, you know, strong motivations we don't ever get access to, you know, like, considering, like, because we have Hamlet's, we have Claudius's, we have Gertrude, I don't know, but, like, Ophelia, like, she loves Hamlet and she wants that to work and she wants to honor her father. Like, Laertes wants to look after his sister. Like, most people's motivations are made fairly clear, but not with them. So maybe they become a sort of a bellwether, or, like, you know, that we kind of how we feel about them reveals kind of what we took from the play, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
I think, but yeah, I had never considered the idea that they might be corrupt as well. I always thought the word that always comes to my mind is that the word putz, you know, like,
they're kind of the bumbling friends, like, that just arrive in to be like, what's going on?
Yeah.
But I do think that now that we've mentioned that they could be corrupt, we could look at them as, like, a tug of war between Hamlet and Claudius. You know, who wins, does Hamlet keep them not corrupt or did Claudius corrupt them? And then, is it a tragedy that Hamlet changed the letter on the way to England, or is it comeuppance, is it payback, is you're not going to get me at Claudius?
I think as soon as he hears from them, like, why are you here, and, like, that the king brought you and invited you here, you know, like, his tail is up then, like, or he's like, he's suspicious of them from the off then. It's sort of like this kind of, again, their intentions might have been positive, but it's done now, you know, it's been corrupted by our knowledge of his duplicitousness, I guess.
And then, just to wrap up there on corruption, so obviously it's a drama, it's a play. How does corruption heighten the drama, or does it heighten the drama in the play? What would you... Yeah.
Well, I think, like we said, it has a knock-on effect. Like, from the very first corrupt deed, to the very last corrupt deed of the poisoning the wine and killing Gertrude. And I think it just has a knock-on effect for disaster in the play. Mm-hmm. Whether it's because of how Hamlet reacted to learning about the corruption that's currently running through his country, or whether it's Claudius's continuous attempts to maintain that corruption, it just seems to lead from one tragedy to the next. And every time another body gets added to the pile at the end of the stage, I think we're more and more confused. You know, was that a just killing, or are we happy that that character has died? Are we sad that they've died? Was Ophelia's death accidental? Was it not? Yeah. And we just have more questions and questions and questions. And I feel like it really draws you into the drama, and you get really invested in the characters, and you start to question, you know, do I even want Hamlet to succeed? Or, you know, actually Laertes has a point. Laertes is in the exact same position as Hamlet. Yeah. His father's been unjustly killed. Mm-hmm. Do we want Laertes to kill him? Or, you know, it makes you question, who are you rooting for? And I think that really makes the play very interesting, and it really makes you pay close attention to try and figure out what is happening in this play. Like, what is going on in this country?
Yeah. It also, it reminds you, so many of the corrupt moments that happen come from arguably not positive, but so some of them are positive, and some mostly it's very understandable circumstances. Like, you're corrupting, you're just telling this little white lie to, like, just try and further your agenda, or just make things a little bit more comfortable in certain instances, and then other ones, they're big moments. But it just reminds us that, like, corruption, again, as George Lee said, is, like, it's very human and very understandable thing to for you to participate in, both wittingly and unwittingly. But I also think it's kind of satisfying that even though you know, Hamlet doesn't survive, and honourable people or whatever don't survive, that all of the corruption produced by Claudius comes around to bite him again. But it wouldn't have occurred only for that Hamlet stood up, you know, like, that ultimately, because he recognised and tried to fight back in as, you know, arguably delayed and as frustrating a fashion as he did, that's what allowed for the corruption to turn back in on itself and to kind of close the circle, so to speak. And now we can get on with Fortinbras and how he's going to corrupt it in a whole new way, and or maybe he's going to live and rule decisively.
As it is, I do feel hopeful at the end that, okay, the corruption is gone now. Yeah, it's, like, all been burned.
That whole game has finished, played itself out. Like, you
there's
know,
no so, players left.
Yeah, exactly. That circle is pushed off to the side now. So you're kind of, you are left with, like, a blank slate, you know.
And hopefully with Hamlet's instructions, you know, tell my story to Horatio, they'll learn something from what happened.
Which is hopefully what we're doing. Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, as often, you know, the death of a king at the end of the play, like, same with Macbeth, you know, that you want the circle to finish, and then there's a chance for something new to kind of come out from there. So it definitely adds to the drama, for sure.
Thank you to the two of you again for coming in and discussing the theme of corruption with us today. If there is anything, another theme that you'd like us to explore, another character, do let your English teachers know, and we will try and fit it in by the end of the year. But look out for another couple of podcasts for the end of the year on some of your Leaving Cert poets. And thank you for listening.
What if this cursed hand were thicker than itself with brother's blood? Is there not rain enough in the sweet heavens to wash it white as snow? Whereto serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense? And what's in prayer but this twofold force to be forestalled ere we come to fall, or pardoned being down? Then I'll look up. My fault is past. But, oh, what form of prayer can serve my turn? Forgive me my foul murder. That cannot be, since I am still possessed of those effects for which I did the murder. My crown, mine own ambition. and my queen. May one be pardoned and retain the offense. In the corrupted currents of this world, offense's gilded hand may shove by justice, and oft is seen the wicked prize itself buys out the law. But 'tis not so above. There is no shuffling. There the action lies in his true nature, and we ourselves compelled, even to the teeth and forehead of our faults, to give in evidence. What then? What rest? Try what repentance can. Oh, what can it not? But what can it when one cannot repent? Oh, wretched state. Oh, bosom black as death. Oh, limed soul that's struggling to be free, art more engaged. Help, angels, make assay. Bow stubborn knees, and heart with strings of steel, be soft as sinews of the newborn babe.